accession number 18560, reel 12.
Harry Simpson, reel 12.
From Gough we left to go to roundabout Mook and prepare for the next offensive, which we were contemplating, which was a Rhine crossing. But we had to do a lot of practice at that. And the only way we could practice on a river similar to the Rhine, or as near to the Rhine peculiarities, was the Maas in Holland. We did quite a number of attacks in buffaloes, well, not attacks, it was manoeuvres across the Maas, until we'd perfected it both night and day. And then we moved up to the Rhine crossing, which was going to be very, very difficult, because the river was flowing very fast. We came up to the banks of the Rhine to be confronted by a mass of smoke, continuous smoke. It was laid in defensive not a defensive position, but defensive from the enemy's point of view as regards observation. And whoever had been there before us had prepared the ground by digging slit trenches and command posts underground, and we took over them. By this time, I got a new company commander, Major Gelston, Bob Gelston. He was a Canadian, a gun chap, and we took over the preparations regarding our company for the Rhine crossing. On briefing by the CO, it came to the conclusion that we would be the assault company across the Rhine, the first across to leave at 9:05 that night on buffaloes. They were supplied by the Northamptonshire Yeomanry. Originally, they were our support. I had been from Normandy in tanks, Sherman tanks. But they took the tanks away from them for the Rhine crossing and issued them with buffaloes. They were track vehicles, similar to a tank, but they had no turret or anything like that. The buffalo was like a personnel carrier. And they were taking us across the Rhine. Major Rollo and Captain Kermach of our battalion, and that chap, I think they called him Pringle, I don't know. But they went off across the Rhine before anybody. But their position was, their job was, to be on the enemy bank, giving us assistance over by dimmed coloured lights. And we converge on those lights. They were there. They'd gone over before. I don't know whether they went over by boat or by rowing boat or what. But they were there, all right. But Major Roller was wounded, Captain Kermack was killed, and so was the corporal with him. We went over, and the currents were so swift that the vehicles we were in were being drifted out by the current, and we were dispersed. We lost our position of crossing. and the positions of landing. I was a bit confused, because we landed in a position that was supposed to have been by another vehicle, whether it was carrying 10 platoon, 11 platoon or 12 platoon, but we as company headquarters landed in one of their positions. And we had one or two sections on it from the other platoons. But on debussing from there and landing at the other side, the other vehicles landed all right. There's mines going off, but they're only small ones, run by the tracks, they weren't doing no damage. But where we landed in anti-personnel mines. And two or three of the chaps that jumped off first of all, I remember a Corporal Thomas, a Welshman. He lost his legs, and one or two other men with him were killed. We landed, when we jumped, we were terrified because we'd seen them go down. We thought, oh God, we gritted our teeth, closed our eyes, and hoped that when we did land, we'd be all right.
Kitty.
We managed to get away with it. And the objectives that night were a place called, I remember the first one was a farmhouse called Potnickel. We were going for that, but the Major decided to bypass it because there was no fire coming from it. He dispatched a couple of men to go to the farmhouse and see there was no enemy there. Which was right, there was no enemy there, so we bypassed it and went on to Kivitz, which was a much bigger place, further on. And we took Kivitz, capturing about 10 or 15 prisoners, and we locked them up in a room under guard within the farmhouse. And we lost no casualties in the advance to these two farmhouses. So having got there, we consolidated. But it was very, very dark, and you couldn't really plan your positions, because it was so dark. So you just got to put them where you thought, within the group as platoons, and in you'd normally done on training. And we were hoping then that everything would be all right. The next morning we go around, we wouldn't have a great deal of moving about to do in the positions. But through the night, I was a bit doubtful with the climate at that time. And being close to the river, we were on the extreme left flank of the bridgehead. I thought that it's been misty. A mist will come down. I'm damn certain a mist will come down in daylight, as was prone to do at that time of the year. So I went upstairs and I climbed through the rafters into the false roof. Knocked some tiles off so they could see out. Dawn was about breaking, and I was very fortunate, because as I'd thought, as I surmised, a mist was settling down, a thick mist, but fortunately it was below the house tiles, and I could see over the top of it, which to my surprise, about 500 or 600 yards, as I estimated it, I saw groups of men assembling, running forward and assembling, and taking cover. I thought that must be the start line. He's going to come back and attack us. So I stayed there. I warned the platoon. I shouted from the position I was in with my head out of the tiles, stand to. And actually everybody stood to us. It's stand to watch your front. And I ordered two-inch mortars that were in the front of the house, in the garden, to prepare. One bomb ranging, at maximum range, 500 yards. The maximum range was a two-inch mortar, was only 500 yards. So at maximum range, I said, one bomb ranging. So they fired, I said, spot on. Leave it at that. Well, then the mist was gradually lowering and lowering, and I could see in the masses of them coming towards us, further towards us. But it was very, very hard to judge a distance as they came into the mist as it was receding. You couldn't see them. So I said, just watch your fronts. And the two-inch mortar, I said, right, two-inch mortars, carry on firing rapid. After two or three rounds, decrease your range by about 50 each time. After two or three rounds, decrease by 50. So they only had to judge, because there were no sights for the two-inch mortar. They had to judge it. And the next thing, the enemy was converging on our left of the main house, to an outbuilding. There's a gap between the outbuilding and the main house and the cowshed, which was attached to the main house. But this gap, I was very doubtful about it, because there was a ditch running down, right in line with it. And the ditch, if any of the enemy got in that ditch, they could approach the house and this gap without being seen by the platoon on the right. And they knew about this, because the night previous we'd had one patrol out probing our defences, and they'd stolen a Bren gun from the section that was in an outbuilding, extreme left of the farm, towards the river. And whoever was in it had left the Bren gun for a cup of tea or something like that, I assume, I don't know. When he came back, the Bren gun had gone. So then we assumed that he was going to concentrate on that gap. You see? Anyway, we kept on firing away then, trying to keep his head down. And then all of a sudden, approaching the gap was a number of personnel. Had one Bren gun further back, covering the gap in a small outbuilding. And he was firing in the gap at an angle. So this was the farm, the cowshed and the outbuilding. He was firing at an angle across it, you see, so that anybody coming to it would be hit by angle of fire. Anyway, I was walking through, prior to that, I came out of the loft, and I went down to the bedroom and looked through the window, and I saw two chaps running across, and they're at the side of the house, two of them, and they had some machine guns. So me, like a fool, I did a thing that you should never do. I exposed myself to shoot them from above, because I knew if they got up the wall, they'd hit the defenders here. So I shot them. And when I looked up to see where they'd come from, which was slightly left, I saw this bloody thing flying through the air. It just looked like a great big football. I thought, oh well, it's a Panzerfaust. So I dropped below the window ledge from the window. Unfortunately, it was a very old house, and it must have been a 2-foot thick wall. If I'm saying 2 foot, but it was a thick wall, and the blast, it didn't come through the wind, but it hit below the window, and all I felt was the explosion and the blast, and it picked me up, threw me across the room, and through the door on top of the steps. Later on, I came back and had a look, and the machine gun that I had that was blown in two. It was bent in two. Tumbling down the steps full of plaster. And I got to the bottom of the steps and rolling over head over tail. And all I saw was six jackboots. But the element of surprise is a great thing when the people who are confronted by it, if they don't have the wits about them, which they didn't, because they'd been under fire and it must have been a terrifying thing. And I saw the jackboots, but it came back to my mind that I was in danger. So I just jumped up and lashed out. The only thing I had was my legs and my fist. And I hit this little chap. He was only about 16. Hit him across the bloody jaw. Down he went. They started crying. The other two, they got their fists up. And I didn't like that when they put the fists up. So I knocked the bloody weapons out of their hand and gave them a belt in the two. Made them prisoner. The chap that I hit in the jaw, I said, send him down the cellar. And they gave him some tea and a bar of chocolate. So I went out back then, see how the machine gunner was doing. And the machine gunner had jammed. So he said, jam, Sergeant Major. I said, for Christ's sake, get it freed then sharp. So with that, I had at the back door three boxes of grenades. There's 12 grenades in each, 36 grenades. So I grabbed hold of them, and of course they were more or less ready primed, just crimped. Slight crimp, and you could pull the pin. So I pulled the pin out, and the major came out with me, and he was throwing grenades to me. I was throwing them over the top of the farmhouse, the cow shed.
This is at Kivett, is it?
Yes. And hell, we created a hell of a chaos there. He couldn't get through up the gap. They were just coming out of there and dropping amongst him. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the battle ensued then. It quieted down eventually. And those that were a bit in the rear of the Germans that were dead in front in the gap there, remainder buggered off back. We saw them scooting off back. And there was about 15 or 20 Germans all laid dead. And then they tried to come through the gap, but got caught in the blast from the grenades. Some of them, I assume that some of them were crawled back to the ditch, and they were more or less all in there when the everything died down, and then the Glengarrians, it was a Canadian-Scottish battalion, were leaving us because we were coming out then for the next attack we were going to make. The Glengarrians took over and we left, reformed, and it was then that we learnt that our divisional commander, General Rennie, had been hit by a mortar bomb and was killed not far from the positions. And then the next attack was a place called Emple Bridge. That was a bit difficult because the ground round about it, the bridge, is a the river was swollen and the ground round about was flooded, very muddy and flooded in parts. A company were in front of us at this point, going up to the bridge. They had to take the bridge, and we, B company, had to take Schloss Empel. It was named House Empel, E-M-P-E-L. The river was Empel, Empel River. But Schloss Empel wasn't occupied, so we took over it, took up positions, and the bridge was slightly to our front left. A humpback bridge. About 50 yards behind the bridge on the enemy side was a wall of some houses in the village, a line of houses in the village. There were some houses on the left. But the first house was occupied by a section of A Company. A Company had taken the bridge, across the bridge, and were in the first house, but they were being heavily fired upon. But they were safe. They were only using machine gun fire against them and rifle fire. And I observed, looking through the window, a blown-out window with the binoculars, to this house on the right, this wall on the right. Behind the wall, I could just see the front, left front of a tank and the muzzle of its gun pointing down. Now, I couldn't traverse to his left, which was, it engaged us in the house. He couldn't move it. The only way he could move his gun forward to engage us was bring the tank forward. But in so doing, he would have exposed himself. So I never bothered about that. We tried to get to it with a pier, but you couldn't. The distance was too great. And you couldn't get across the river because it was flowing fast. And you couldn't go over with a pier because the ammunition would be soaked. So we just laid there and did what we could. Strengthening with some positions and looking, observing where the enemy were. And we noticed that from the road and the bridge on the left here, and the row of houses going up, it seemed to curve. The row of houses seemed to curve a bit, about 200 or 300 yards in front of us, so on the other side of the river. And this big tree, it was a very big tree as well, a big base, big trunk. There was movement round about there. But you couldn't really define how many men were there. And we couldn't get over it anyway because the river flowing down. So we forgot about it. And in A Company, Jimmy Brander and A Company, they were behind us on the road. And behind them was battalion headquarters. And from battalion headquarters, we saw this weasel being driven up the road. And it came through A Company. And the weasel was just belting on it, the Red Cross flying. And I thought, bloody hell, he's going to cross the bridge. So I got the blend gun and fired a burst of machine gun fire across the front of the vehicle as it was moving up. But it took no notice of it. It was so keen on driving. I learnt later that he would have been this chap. He carried on just as approaching the bridge. He was hit by this shell, explosive shell, and just a blow up. And his body was blown out in the air. And it was a chap called George Gardner, came from Dundee. Lad. But when we were driving, driver training, we came to the conclusion that that he wasn't going to be a good driver because he couldn't drive in traffic. So we gave him a job as a medical attendant or attendant to the medical staff. But being that he could drive all right in the field or on the road when there was nobody else on. And whoever, I think it was Mr. McGowan or Geordie Strang, gave him permission to drive this weasel to come up and try and get some of the wounded men out from the house on the left. But this bloody tank saw it, and he was flying a Red Cross, and he just fired and blew it up. Poor old Geordie. Well, that was it. Mr. McNamara, from there we had to send out the patrol to cross the river, but he couldn't cross the river on our side of the bridge or on the opposite side, the left-hand side of the bridge. He had to go further down to find a place across the river whereby he could cross it with safety and get behind the enemy. But I saw him come out of the river further down, about 200 or 300 yards down. And he was exposed when he hit the field. He came under fire and then had to get back. He got back all right and rejoined the company. Well, then everything was quiet. And I decided to keep an observation on this big tree that was in front of us. I just mentioned it a few moments ago. And then I saw a movement, and whoever it was, he must have just come on or not, or just forgotten himself, but he wasn't doing the, so he didn't have the soldier's instinct of cover. The background of the tree trunk was dark, with his face was white, and he crossed it, and that's just what I saw. And next to me was Joe Black, a sniper. We, instead of saying to him, telling him about this person and to keep an observation, I took the rifle because I'd seen the person, and I kept my eyes on him, and looking through the telescope, I aimed at him, and I thought, well, if I aim a bit lower, because it's really hard to judge with the weather roundabout. So I aimed lower that down than his face, and that was it. I didn't see him. He disappeared. 2 or 3 minutes later, I observed the house behind him. 2 men running up the path, and they burst through the door, and that was it. I thought, bloody hell. I put the weapon down. I could have had another go. Anyway, they got away with it. But there was a chap walking way up the field, about 500 or 600 yards away, across the fields, up top. And he was a German Red Cross man. He had the Red Cross on his arm, his Red Cross sight. So, and I thought, well, I won't shoot that bugger, poor bugger. They did it with Johnny, but we'll leave him. Because you never knew when they were going to help you or help their own. So let him get away with it. Well, that was it then. The next morning, the 1st Battalion Black Watch advanced, and they went through us in the village and on. And of course, it was a game of pursuit after that, advancing to contact.